Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 278 of the Morning Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
We have Mark Rubin on the line from San Jose, California.
Hello.
What did you do last week, Jaime? Well, you missed us.
Last week, that's right. I was in Springfield, Missouri for a work trip.
Springfield? Oh, Springfield. Really?
Yeah, I got an office out there that was pretty convenient for a lot of folks to meet at, considering a fair number of the attendees were in that area.
Yeah.
Got to try the famous Springfield style cashew chicken.
Oh, yeah.
Their take on a Chinese dish, supposedly that originated from there.
Sorry, which state is this in? Because there's like 13 Springfields in the United States.
Missouri.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool. What's it like down there? I guess you're from the South, so is it very similar?
They're in the Midwest, although it definitely does feel more Southern in terms of sort of style and setting.
That's where Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer are from, that area, right?
Pretty close, because Mississippi's not too far away.
Oh, they're from Mississippi?
I think it's Mississippi.
That's a state? Oh, okay. Yes. Missouri's a state too, right?
Missouri is a state as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so is Mark Twain from Mississippi?
Mark Twain's from San Francisco.
Oh, but he wrote about the Mississippi River, right?
Mississippi River's pretty long.
Yeah, I know, but where does Tom Sawyer take place?
I think it actually could be Missouri.
Really? Okay.
Or Kansas. Yeah, that's the Missouri River Mississippi River is the border between Kansas and Missouri. It might be the Missouri River. I don't know.
Just be
some random river. Might have nothing to do with Mississippi, too.
Right. But Mississippi's a state, though, too, right?
Yes, it is.
Just to confuse the rest of us in the
world. It is a state and a river.
Right. It's just like two Washingtons, two Portlands.
You say that, and there is a York. And granted, we had the nicety to call ours New to differentiate it from other York. And you also have, a London, which makes...
Well, no, actually, did you know what the original name for Toronto is?
No idea.
York. Duh.
Wait, so you have a York.
We're York, and that's why New York had to be New York. Huh?
Whatever the six is, the area codes, the province.
The 416 boroughs. Was originally called York. Yeah. Mm. Back in Stone Age days, yes. Or early white man days of the 1600s or whatever.
I don't think that's the reason New York is New York, though, Tim. I hate to tell you.
No?
No.
It was called New Amsterdam, though.
It was originally New Amsterdam, yeah. When it was a Dutch colony.
Right.
And then the British took over the colony. They changed the name and named it after the Duke of York.
Okay.
But they kept the New because it sounded more like the current name of the city.
Yeah. So, the people at home are trying to figure out what the hell this has to do with cashew chicken.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? Maybe Tom Sawyer did have it. I'm looking up here. The fictional town of St. Petersburg, Missouri. He has an aunt, Sally Phelps, who lives very much further down the Mississippi, referring to the river in this case.
Mm. Okay. Oh, okay. All right. So what you were telling us about Missouri, Missouri. You're telling us about that. Springfield
got it's very suburban, so you definitely have to drive to places. They have a ton of really, really nice craft beer locations, so that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
surprisingly not known for barbecue, considering its proximity, you know, at least in my mind, like, you know, I growing up in Texas, like, I have a very different opinion on the size of states. So to me, mm-hmm. Kansas City seems not that far away, even though I'm sure it's probably a couple hundred miles away. Mm-hmm. But I assumed that, or even like pick St. Louis, right? Same thing. I thought they'd be good at barbecue, but nope, the Chinese food, the cashew chicken was sort of their thing. Hmm. That was cool. I learned.
Was it good and spicy and stuff, or what's the deal?
It's very different. It's very cultivated for Midwest taste. So it's essentially fried chicken, like the kind you'd get, you know, KFC or Church's Chicken.
Popeyes.
And then you put the sauce on top that's almost like gravy in terms of texture uh-huh. profile. And you've got some cashews and some rice.
Oh, like the actual chunky cashew. And what's the gravy like, though? Is it like beef gravy or?
I actually don't chicken know gravy? What goes into cashew chicken normally, but, you know, right. MSG presumably is what.
Yeah.
It's like a main ingredient. I'm not really sure.
Really ties it together. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. The dish I had, you know, fried wontons and egg roll. Mm. And they're apparently, I did not get a chance to try this, but somebody sent this to me afterwards that there is a lot of innovation in the cashew chicken area, where there is apparently a taco truck over there that has tacos it sells, where the shell is made of wonton. Yeah, the chicken, the cashew chicken in there is the filling. And a different place has decided to make the container a wonton, but in the shape of a waffle cone.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of innovation there.
There's I a guess. billion people in China right now just kind of twitching when you say this stuff.
Well, it's not Chinese food. It's just attribute it that, right?
Yeah.
They just laugh at us.
Yes.
It's Chinese food as sort of produced for folks who were living in the U.S. and had to sell to U.S. tastes, mm-hmm. particularly of that era.
All right. So the other question we have for you is, did you listen to last week's episode?
I did. I didn't get all the way through it. I think I have maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes left.
Okay. All right. Yeah, because I think there were some questions in there for you.
Oh, I heard one of them that I don't know the answer to. I'd have to Google it. And that's, I don't think
you can use the Switch Pro, right? That was the question.
Oh, the Pro. I hadn't thought about that. I was thinking of the Joy-Cons.
Nintendo Switch Pro, Pro joystick with the Apple TV.
Interesting. I was thinking of the Joy-Cons. I was like, well, no, the Joy-Cons aren't going to work. But the Pro is probably, sure.
The Joy-Cons are the things on the side that come with?
Yes, the motion control style ones that also split apart.
Yeah, but they're not. They're proprietary. Can you pair them with a different Switch or whatever? Or?
Probably with a different Switch, but I'm not aware of being able to pair them with other devices the way that you can, the Xbox and PlayStation 4 controllers.
Right. All right. I guess we'll accept that as an answer, eh, Mark?
Yep.
Anywho, all right. So starting off, we talked about Margaret Hamilton, the awesome computer programmer and software hardware developer who worked on the Apollo missions and wrote much of the code that took man to the moon. But turns out it's sort of a funny name, because Margaret Hamilton is also the name of the actress who played most famously the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz. So she was an actor who was signed to a studio actor, I guess, actress. And so she was in a number of films back then, but she's most notably known for her role as the Wicked Witch of the West.
Are you sure they're not the same person?
They are not the same person. So when you Google, I discovered this because I wanted to Google to find, you know, the picture, which is a picture of Margaret Hamilton, the computer programmer, who standing beside the printout of her code, which is as tall as she is. Because back then they used to use those dot matrix printers to print out, you know, their programs, right? And check them and things like that. So she like the actual logic or program or whatever they made that took them to the moon and back or whatever was as tall as she was when you printed it out and stacked it up. So, I mean, Alexa said last week it was a stack of books, but it's actually a stack of that, those printouts. I don't know if you remember. Do you ever work on baby systems or IBM systems, Mark, and have those big giant printouts that your accounting departments used to use for reports?
Sure did. And they always had that the detachable edges of the paper with the holes in it.
Yeah. And it was like end to end. It was like they were all accordion style, I guess. They would just fold onto each other. And
nobody under 40 knows what we're talking about, Tim. With the edges, with the edges, with the holes in the edge.
The dot matrix printer style?
Yeah.
I guess the dot matrix did use that too. I guess so. Okay.
All right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the original Image Writer had paper like that, right? But it didn't have the paper we're talking about, Jaime, had like, it was like, you know, sometimes you see an Excel spreadsheet and it's like every second line is sort of a blue color, so white blue. blue, white, blue, white, blue, mm-hmm, like that. Mm-hmm. That paper had that kind of imprinted on it already. And they were about as wide as a keyboard. I want to say like almost 20 inches wide, I guess, right?
Yep.
19 inches, let's say. And you would print like on, you know, portrait style or landscape style. And you would feed from the front of the printer and they would come out the back of the printer and they would just stack nicely because they were accordion folded, right? And you would tear them off and run off to the, look what I've discovered and Eureka and all that kind of stuff. Back when, and you'd have these big binders that you'd put your code in and flip through it and stuff. We used to use it for everything, libraries and record keeping and, yeah, it was crazy stuff. Anyway, now we use PDFs for everything. Anyway, turns out, so we were also talking, the other fact check, we were talking about the iPhone XS or the iPhone with Face ID. I know that when I had my iPhone X, which is the original Face ID phone, that if I was on the couch or lying down, I couldn't use the Face ID with my phone held sideways. And I don't know if it has to do with the iPhone XS or not. And since the new iPads with Face ID came out, they had the horizontal landscape orientation. You could still recognize your face. But I was able to unlock my phone, as Mark said, holding my head on the side and my phone on its side too. But I'm not sure if that's particular to the iPhone XS. Maybe our fans can let us know. But I was able to unlock my phone in sideways mode. What phone do you have currently, Mark?
I can do that on my iPhone X.
I wonder if they updated it in the operating system somewhere. Because it was like one of my most annoying things about Face ID in general.
I don't know.
Yeah. All right, so I'll cover the Ask Anthony JC since it's all me, as Jaime says. We were talking, we've been talking about, you know, Fred Rogers and you guys probably knew, do you guys know Captain Kangaroo too?
Sure.
So this year is the 50th anniversary of Sesame Street. And actually, Carol Spinney just passed away this last past weekend at the age of 85, I believe. He was he played the character of Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch for 50 years or so. He just stepped down last year, but he just passed away this weekend. So, you know, rest in peace and all that stuff. But the video I've got here in the Ask MTJC is a guy named Ernie Coombs, who's also no longer with us. But he was in a show called Mr. Dress Up, which is another show that most Canadians grew up on watching. And he did arts and crafts, and he had had this tree. It's over at the CBC building downtown. You can go to Mr. Dress Up's tree and take your picture beside it. And in the tree lived his little friend Casey and Finnegan, which were very similar to Fred Rogers. Had the trolley and the little cat that he talked to, Tiger, I think, right? Daniel Tiger, I think. Yes, it is Daniel Tiger. Now I think about it, who's now gone on after Mr. Rogers to be a famous character. But Casey and Finnegan were the two. It was the little boy and his dog that Mr. Dressup would talk to. And in this video, it got posted here. He's showing kids how to make stockings for their friends, like Christmas stockings, right? And the interesting fact is that my dog's second name is Finnegan because he looks like Finnegan the dog from the show. So that's that. And I posted it with Ask MTGC, so I'd be forced to talk about it. Anywho, all right. So moving on, I put this article here, and it's a two-parter, really, from Krebs on Security about location services in the iPhone 11 Pro. There's been a lot of questioning about, you know, iOS 13's tendency to tell you about apps that are using location, especially if they're on set to always. Like, I have a tile on my keys and Carol's keys and my, you know, I can on the phones as well, and it pops up at least once a week to tell me that it's using location services. I also use location services on my Nest, which is my thermostat, so that when I'm out of the house, it knows that nobody's home, and it can, you know, go into like a low energy mode and not, you know, keep the house nice and toasty because we're not here. But for those two particular features to work, location services has to be set to always for those to be able to, for that, you know, for it to communicate with their network stuff. But the article I've got here on Krebs on Security is about the fact that with location services, you can turn off location services. There's a global toggle in the system settings. You can turn it off completely, or you can go individually and turn off location services per app, right? So that if you're concerned about, you know, tracking and all that kind of stuff. And it turns out that you can turn all of the location services off on your phone, and it still does some location tracking, or it does some location service stuff and communicates with Apple and all that kind of stuff, because occasionally you see the little arrow that points, you know, that shows that your location is being used at that point in time. And so they wrote an article, this gentleman here on Krebs, and the article written by
Brian Krebs, according Brian to Krebs. Twitter.
Yeah, well, he's written this article. Anyway, so this is posted on the 3rd of December, and when I grabbed it and stuck it on here, he posted a video and he sent a notice over to Apple to sort of inquire about why they're doing this. He speculated on what he thought it might be, and then there's a follow-up article, which he's updated on the 5th, takes to another story, where Apple has responded saying that it's using the ultra-wide Wi-Fi band, I think it's called. It's a service where, you know, in iPhone 11 Pro and Pro Max, you can point your phone at another user of a similar device, and you can do like a targeted airdrop with them, or air sharing. Ultra wide band, which is or UWB. And apparently it does this to sort of detect whether or not there's any other UWB devices in range of this phone. In this follow-up article, he also talks about the fact that there's some countries where they have not allowed ultra wide band technology to be used at all. So sort of a puzzler on location services. I don't know if you guys have discussed or come across issues with location services in your travels in the last couple of months.
Not really. I mean, it actually, if anything, it seems like it's gotten less frequent with a couple of the latest updates. I haven't really noticed it. Maybe I just got used to it and started ignoring it.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of these things like it's funny. I was thinking about this when I was reading this article earlier today to refresh myself. There was a story a while ago, I think, where a Google representative was before Congress talking about how they were trying to explain to Google that, you know, even though the senator or whoever was questioning them had an Android device, and he says, I turn off location services and you're still tracking my location. I think it's a similar kind of, probably a similar kind of thing to this, that there's something in the system that in order to make your phone, you know, have a relatively decent experience, I guess it's trying to figure out where you are and what's around you, right? Like sniffing for networks and stuff like that. That's another reason why Apple says they do this as well. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts, comments?
This one was kind of interesting to unpack because it's related to a feature that like a lot of people aren't necessarily using like directly. I think AirDrop does make use of it, and for the time being, until they release the Apple Tile or whatever it is they're calling the Bluetooth tag, you know, Bluetooth wideband sort of thing that's going to come out. Who knows when? Because it's just been sort of leaked, and nobody really has an idea of the product itself.
Right.
So it's related to that they were using this technology that apparently requires them to check to verify that they are not in certain areas of the world that this is restricted. And in order to do that, they have to figure out where your location is, regardless of what you've done to turn off location services. Now, in this case, Apple is saying, well, that stuff doesn't leave the device. So it's not communicating back to Apple where your location is, just that your device is like, hey, am I in restricted zone? No? Okay, cool. Moving on. It got weird because Apple, I think it was probably the right UI in this case. Like, it could have been handled better, but as a sort of a fail-safe. In this case, location services was getting triggered. And people are like, what the heck? I turned everything off. What's going on?
Right.
Turns out there was this missing thing of like, oh, by the way, we have to ask for it, you know, when we're using this technology, and rest assured, it never leaves the device. We're just checking locally. I don't know if that made people feel a lot better, but probably a little bit better than they ended up in this case, where it seemed like, what the heck is still calling location services? But at least whatever under the covers in iOS itself that says, hey, yes or no, flip a bit, you know, is location services on? It's like, yes, it is. Not in the way a user might think, but it definitely was on. So it wasn't like they were hiding it per se, just really poorly communicated.
It's also odd in the fact that you know, they've been having all these commercials lately displaying how they're conscious of privacy and they protect your, you know, this is most secure phone in the world, as according to Apple sort of thing. And it's doing this kind of questionable stuff. But
this one's weird because it does fall into the, it's protecting your privacy, right? It's, you know, it's not giving away your location there. It's communicating it in a really poor fashion. And it is sort of, like, it doesn't make you feel good about your privacy, right? Like, let's be really clear that, like, it is a terrible experience. And it's sort of like going up to your friend and be like, hey, just wanted to let you know, I didn't hit you in the face with a brick. You're like, what? Yeah. Was that like an option? No, it wasn't. Yeah. But I just wanted you to confirm with you that I was not going to do that. Like, oh, all right, I feel less good now than before you told me about this situation.
So it's a bit like, so I guess you haven't seen the TV show C yet, right?
No, I have not.
No, okay. Well, I'm going to, a bit of a spoiler here, but so as you know, Jason Momoa's character, he doesn't, he lacks vision, right? He's blind, but he's like the leader of this tribe, and he has this big giant sickle shaped sword that he uses to smote his enemies, right? But as he's walking around, he's got to try and sort of feel what's in front of him and sort of try and find his enemies and stuff like that, right? And he walks around by swiping this big giant sword in front of him on the ground, like people use a white cane kind of thing, right? But he does it in sort of like a, you know, like slicey, you know, slicing back and forth motion. It's kind of like they're checking to see if there's an enemy around with this big giant knife, right? But oops, sorry if we actually nick you on the way by, you know? Is that too extreme analogy, you think? Or?
I don't know that I really got the analogy, but I understand the intent.
Well, if you're trying to find, you know, you're trying to orient, imagine you can't see and you have to orient yourself to the environment. And the only tool you have at your avail is a knife, a big sword. And you kind of swing the sword around to make sure there's no enemies around. And if you happen to nick a foe as you're walking by with your swipey motion, you know, kind of like, you know, they have to turn on privacy to make sure that they're not breaking the rules about privacy or turn on location, right? It's an odd argument. But anyway, yeah, so I guess we can all sleep at night knowing that Apple is, like, you know, doing things to protect us in spite of this weird location puzzler. All right, over to you, Jaime.
Yeah, I put this one in follow-up for giggles. So around this time last year, we found out when the App Store would be shutting down for reviews. Mm-hmm. And guess what? It's around the same time. In fact, it's the same exact time this year. It
really?
Is December 23rd to the 27th. It's at least three different years in a row that I've seen this.
So is this like the same dates as the... Because this is 2 days before Christmas and a couple of days after, right?
Yeah. I'd always wondered if they did it just because I never really...
It's Monday to Friday in this year, so
yeah, which works out sort of smashingly. But looking at previous years, 2018 and 2017, it was the same dates, which didn't line up quite as nicely for, you know,
really,
huh, for, you know, long vacation time sort of thing. So if you're listening to this episode and you still have a release to do, you should do it post haste or hold off on it. You know, you don't want to have a bad build up there and then be completely unable to do anything about it.
True. Yeah, I think that it makes sense that it's 5 days in a row, but then also, I guess the reality is that the App Store works 24/7, 7 days a week, right? So it's not like that you can't get an app reviewed on a weekend sort of thing, right? So a couple of days before the holiday and a couple of days afterwards, right?
Yeah. And thankfully, it lines up pretty nicely, so I'm sure there's going to be
this year. It does, yeah.
Taking some nice lengthy holidays from the, what is it, the 21st to the 29th, I would guess.
Mm-hmm. All right, what's up next? You're up next again.
Yeah, this one I thought was interesting. So we've talked about subscriptions and, you know, fatigue around them and things getting out of hand. One that I do remember people talking about, I do not recall if we talked about it ourselves on the show, but I thought there was a good chance we did. So BMW had said that, hey, you like CarPlay? Cool. We know you have a lot of money, so we're just going to charge you $80 a year for BMW owners to use, basically subscribing to CarPlay on the BMW set of vehicles. But now they've done an about face and said, oh no, actually we're not going to have that annual requirement of subscription. So hooray, it's free for BMW folks.
Who can afford $80? Hello.
Yeah, that was one of the ones of like, all right, so what's the Venn diagram of people who can afford BMWs but not afford $80 per year? It definitely smacked of nickel and diming because you could, and it probably makes your you know, annual and quarterly reports look really, really good. Of like, hey, look at this revenue stream. It costs us nothing to implement.
Right.
But I think in this case, they've decided to do what I believe to be the right thing.
So what Jaime's neglected to mention is this is in the U.S. only. Because, you know, CarPlay users outside of the U.S. will have to pay a additional £235 for a lifetime subscription.
Some BMW owners may need to pay an additional £235 for a lifetime subscription. So that's weird. I don't know why there would be, like, it sort of makes sense as a, this is an add-on thing, right? You got the plush velour interior. All right, that's an add-on from whatever.
But doesn't it come leather with CarPlay? It's not like an extra. You probably have to pay like an arm and a leg to have the CarPlay option in the first place. Too,
you
right?
probably have to pay to get the, you know, specific rear view mirror that you want. I'm sure, right? If you really wanted to customize it. So it kind of makes sense, even though it's still kind of ticky-tack for a premium product like a BMW. But I don't understand why they've made it different for USA versus non-USA.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it's a wireless CarPlay, so you don't have to plug it into your your lightning cable like an animal. I could do another machine, other cars. But it's interesting because CarPlay is generally free, I would think. Like, you know, you have to pay for the unit. Like, I know to get one aftermarket one, they're like $700-$800 kind of thing to get them. Maybe different prices now, but and we've always talked about this, like how does it get updated? Like, how does CarPlay get, you know, the next version of the OS? Like, a new OS comes every year, right? Is it like a firmware upgrade that you plug your BMW into your lightning cable and update it or something? Or, you know, how does it find updates and things like that? Maybe that's where they thought the pricing was going to come in, that, you know, would you know, I would think if you're paying $80 a year, you're getting a new update every year too, right? Wouldn't you?
If there was some sort of engineering maintenance cost around what you're talking about, that would make you know, justifiable sense as to why they would charge this sort of thing. It kind of feels like, well, they should just charge you when the upgrade happens. You know, you take it into the dealership. But on the other hand, it does seem ticky-tack compared to like Tesla, who's like, hey, here's this new update. You can update your phone. Sorry, you can update your Tesla from your phone wirelessly, which is pretty neat.
My car doesn't have CarPlay, but it does have it has an entertainment system that downloads updates every once in a while.
Yeah.
But I've never had to pay for those. They do want me to pay for a map upgrade, you know, new map data that I haven't gotten around to doing it because maps haven't changed that much in the past year.
Right.
But yeah, it would be.
Have an iPhone as well, right?
And I have an iPhone as well, right? Right.
I don't know. I mean, and it's funny though when you think about, oh, it's £235 for a lifetime subscription. What is the lifetime of an actual phone? I mean, that a person owns a car. You know, if you're leasing a car, it's going to be 2 years, right? So, and if you're buying a car, like, I mean, I'm crazy because I keep cars for like 17 years and that kind of stuff, right? But like, who else keeps their car?
I keep cars at least 10 years.
Do you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Right. I know that people flip their cars all the time, especially if they're in the leasing situation, right?
Yeah.
Because so, I think the average lifetime of a car for a lot of people is like 2 years, right? So,
yeah, maybe.
And that could be based around their it's an expensive hobby to keep owning cars, right? Like, if you're paying for them outright.
But it costs more to lease them.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the long run. Yeah.
I don't know. It's one of those arguments. So I don't know if you've heard the old adage that, you know, a car starts depreciating the minute you drive it off the lot.
Oh, of course it does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the argument is that yes, over the same period of time, you will pay more for a lease than you would for owning the car.
Right.
But the argument goes, well, with the lease, every 2 years you get a brand new car.
And
you don't when you own the car.
Right. You get a brand new crappy car. True. All right. Anyway, this is next story is a follow-up on our friend Alexis, who was on the show talking about Emacs, and he was talking about some of the shortcuts that are available. So I found a link here for the show. I put this in actually last week's show notes, but I thought I'd talk about it today, that there's an article here I found for 59 shortcuts for Emacs, for those of you driving at home, in case you're running, you know, all the different things do, opening files and saving and all these other crazy things that Emacs does. So Emacs is built into Mac OS, is that right? Or
yeah, it comes with Unix.
The terminal app, right?
I'm actually still pretty amazed that people use it, but people love it.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's one of those, you know, what do you call them? Is it religious war I'm looking for? Is that the terminology where people have, you know, their favorite editor, right?
Yeah.
So, I actually used VI. You'd be proud of me, Mark. I used VI a couple times this week.
Yeah, I guess I shouldn't complain because I still do use VI.
I use Ed, which, you know, still my favorite editor. But yeah, just the other day I had to go in and update my HTTPD config in my Mac, because when I stuck Catalina on it last week, it clobbered my PHP, which I need to do some development with, right? So for APIs and stuff. So every time I upgrade my OS, a major upgrade, I have to go in because it erases the current HTTP daemon config and puts a new one in for Apache. So yeah, so I have to go uncomment the PHP and reboot, you know, or restart the Apache. Anywho, yeah. So, but I actually did use, I normally would like cat the file to read it if I wanted to read the whole thing, but, you know, just usually I use Ed, but last week I used VI just, you know, for the sake of science. That was fun. Alrighty. Another follow-up again from Alexis last week. I think he actually posted, he gave us this in our Slack afterwards. This is from a mathematics.com. No, from Stack Exchange. Fourier Transform for Dummies is the article heading here. So I guess the theory of, you know, about the travel of the sun around the moon and, you know, planets and things like that, all sort of, you know, figuring out the math used to sort it out. It's not that long, but it's a quick little article on I guess, the history of Fourier Transform. transforms and how they came to be in math and science, so, and what people would use them for. That's follow up from that. So off to you, Jaime.
Yeah, the title of this is out of date, in particular by the time this episode comes out.
Yeah.
But it was true as of the 9th when I posted this one on. You can order the Mac Pro and the Mac Pro Display XDR starting tomorrow, which was yesterday. By the time this podcast comes out, it is certainly out there. And apparently, if you add the wheels, the $400 wheels to your Mac Pro, you add a month to your delivery time. So
what?
Keep that in mind. Yeah. $400 if you wanted the wheels.
Wow.
Yeah.
And does an Apple technician come to your house and set it up for you like they did with the 20th century Mac?
I mean, maybe if you, if you live downhill from them, and you can just go kart, boxcar race it on the way down. Yeah. And I don't know what this translates to other denominations, but apparently it maxes out at $52,599 US.
That's why I posted in the article, can I borrow $65,000 Canadian?
Oh, is that what that is? Okay, yeah. Got it. I didn't see that right below the
there's
link.
There's no link in the...
No, there's no link here, but I was doing the I went in and added it up, and I came, like you said, I came up to, I had to put in the Magic Trackpad and the Magic Keyboard, right? Just because, you know, I had to have it, right? I already have Final Cut Pro and Logic, so I didn't need to add those to the order, but I, you know, chose the biggest RAM and everything was like maxed out, and it's ridiculous. So it's funny, I was talking to a colleague at work today. When I first got involved in computer consulting, we used to sell, well, you didn't sell it, but we were aligned with AGFA, and they used to sell a thing called Color Studio and something else. And what they were was a single workstation running like a sort of a flavor of Unix that would only do like Photoshop kind of stuff, color retouching and cloning and things like that. And the other only did page layout like Quark Express or InDesign, right? And the page layout system was like $60,000 and the Photoshop system was like $80,000. And I got in trouble because I said to a client once, you can do that on a Mac with Photoshop for like 10 grand. And of course that got back to AGFA and they called me and my boss into onto the carpet and said, you know, why would you tell a customer that? And then because it's true, you know, anyway, what did I know? But now we're back to these like workstation prices. Like this is not a Mac Pro. It should be called a Mac workstation because at $65,000, who is buying that? I mean, other than maybe a video mogul or something like that, or movie producer or record producer.
Well, you could argue that it should be called a Mac Pro and all the other stuff that's called Pro should really not be called Pro.
Right.
Because it truly is a Pro device.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like we're back to the workstations we had, you know, 20, 30 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This one, to Mark's point, really does seem to deserve the Pro moniker if you compare it to other things that are like, why is this Pro? Because it's more expensive.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Thank you. I can take my professional Instagram photos with stuff, right? Like, I don't know. I was being really glib last night because I happened to be watching on television Ellen DeGeneres's greatest giveaways, where she's partnering with people and giving away tons of money to, you know, people who are very needy or, you know, went through a lot of trauma or tragedy.
Right.
And I couldn't help but think after seeing the $52,599 thing, I'm like, I now measure things in currency when it comes to denominations in increments of Mac Pro. I'm like, oh, they gave this person $100,000. I'm like, that's not even two Mac Pros. I feel like you could dig a little deeper and give some more.
Yeah.
It's really, it really warps your whole perspective on it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the unit of currency is just the stand by itself. Is the stand, is it still $1,000? Have you announced the price on that? Oh, here, they got the prices here. What did the, I didn't check, the monitors, so at, $5,000, $4,999. That's not bad for a monitor.
Right, but I think it doesn't come with a Visa mount, which is a couple hundred bucks more, or the $1,000, or $999, excuse me, less than $1,000, sub-$1,000 dongle that can put it on a stand.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not even sure who the stand is really for, because a lot of people say, like, well, you'd probably would have the arm mounts if you're the Pixars of the world.
Yeah.
You have several of these, and you arrange them with, you know, more desk space.
Right.
And you can arrange them, you know, much more freely. So really unclear. I'd love it if they ever broke out the sales of the stand itself, because I'm very curious who that market is.
Yeah. Well, it, you know, typical of, like you were just talking about the $400 wheels, which would delay you, right? Like, so as a reseller, I would cringe when a product like this came out, because invariably I would get four or five people call me on like the first week and say, I got to have one of these things. And I would go and place an order, and it'd be like, oh, it's going to be like 6 weeks or something, you know, or it'd be like, we can get you the monitor in like 2 weeks, but it's going to be a month and a half for the stand. Like that kind of weird distribution logic used to come up all the time. So I just can't imagine what I feel for the people who are like the resellers of the world who have to sort of figure out how to get these devices into people's hands, right? Unlike the Apple Store where, you know, they constantly have stock. The other thing that we should mention too is there is a rack mount version of this device, but it's also marked as coming soon. So we don't know when or how that's going to come to see the light of day, right? That's if you're going to use one of these things as like a render machine or a server or something like that, right? But I think, you know, we talked about this at work too, because we currently use Mac Pros, like the trash can Mac Pros, as build servers, and we have like a number of them, and I think we're thinking like the next bunch of Macs we'll buy for build servers are going to be like Mac Minis, you know, because you can rack mount two Mac Minis side by side in rack mount. And
yeah, you certainly don't need Mac Pro power for build servers, but
and the new Minis are quite, you know, they're quite the stats on them are quite good, right?
Yeah. So I've been saying for a while, I've been considering for my next home machine to not even get a laptop at all, just get a Mac Mini and use it with my big monitor, because, you know, that's kind of how I work these days at home.
Well, and then what you could do too, Mark, is you could get yourself an AstroPad dongle for your Mac Mini.
Yeah.
And get yourself a 12-inch Mac Pro, and you already got your Bluetooth keyboard, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you probably just you can sit on your couch, and like I do, and just work on your Pro as your monitor to your Mac, right?
Yeah, sure. So,
and you can work anywhere in your house with it like that, you know, as long as the Bluetooth reaches.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yeah, there's lots of options to do that, right? Like I still have the old Thunderbolt display here, and so I'm sitting at my desk right now, and my computer is plugged into the Thunderbolt display, and that's what I'm looking at. But you know, when I'm done the podcast, I just unplug all the plugs on my MacBook Air, and I go sit back on the couch again, right? So yeah, flexibility. I also have two Mac Minis that I use as servers myself. So that, I don't know, interesting to see who's going to be buying these things.
Yeah, it does make me think, because I've seen people get a little bit hurt about this being called Pro. I'm like, all right.
Hmm.
Fair point. There's a very sort of narrow set of pros of which this is for. It almost feels like you needed like Mac Ultimate or Mac Mega, you know, Mac Kaiju or something. Like, you know, if you're an iOS developer, you're still professional too. Don't feel bad. You can still continue to buy pro stuff. But if you need the most extreme thing, you know, Mac Extreme, you know, since all stuff from the 90s.
The Mac Pro Max.
Mac Pro Max. Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Yeah, Mac Pro Max. I do know I come from print and publishing, and there's a lot of like ad agencies where, you know, you have, you know, high powered art directors and creative types who I know for sure will be buying these devices and sticking them in on their desks, and so that, you know, have like a power workstation kind of thing. I don't know if they'll max out like the full meal deal. I mean, what does it start at? $5,000, right? $599 or something like that. $5,999. What's the base price of this thing with 256?
Yeah, I think it is $599 or $5,999.
So let's talk about this. What significantly is different than this in terms of processor and stuff, right? Like compared to the iMac Pro, is it still Intel i7 i9s?
I don't recall. I didn't go and try pricing one out, and I knew from the get-go that this was not going to be
a device. Oh, these are Xeons. They're like the old server Xserve processors. Xeon Ws, the 3.5 gigahertz, 8-core processor, or 12-core, or 16-core, or 24-core, or 28-core. Yeah, so if you're doing like a lot of video rendering and stuff like that, where you're doing multi-threaded stuff, that would certainly come in. 56 threads, according to this, the top spec one. Yeah, so if you're doing a lot of processing, I guess you could do that, right? RAM configurations from 32 gig to 768 gig. Sorry, 1.5 terabytes of RAM. So from 32 gig to 1.5 terabytes of RAM. That's crazy. On the video cards, so it's not even going
to work. Wow, adding 1.5 terabytes adds 25K to the price.
Just the RAM.
Just the RAM from 32
gig. And wait,
to
it only has terabyte. One power supply? What the heck is that about? lots of expansion slots, obviously. You got the afterburners for heavy duty rendering, accelerator cards. And yeah, the base model comes with 256 gigs of storage, which we already know is tight for Xcode, right?
Yeah.
All the way up to 8 terabytes for with two 4 terabyte modules. Of course, it has the T2 chip. Two 10 gigabit Ethernet ports. Is that the fastest they can come up with? I guess that's pretty quick, right? But T1 speeds.
T1 speed is 100 megs.
Is it 100?
Yeah. 100 T1 megs? Is very slow these days.
Oh. Well, that's an expensive machine. I'm sure I'll have one someday just for the sake of having one, but I'll probably wait like 10 years before I get it. And they're on the, you know, on the way out, being replaced by the Mac Pro Max 2.
Like a yard sale or something?
Yeah. Aluminum recycler or something like that. Alrighty. So this is a next article is a follow-up on, we were talking about ethical implications and AI. This is an article I found today as I was on my commute talking about the ethical implications of conversational AI. That the thing is that conversational AI is becoming a big thing in customer service. According to this article, quite a few companies are now using AI as a sort of frontline for tech customer support. IBM predicts it'll be, IBM says that, like, you know, 85% of customer interactions will, by 2020, will be handled by computers. Where are we now? That's next year, right? Yeah. And it's interesting because of the way AI works, they can actually, from your tone as you're speaking to them, they can infer, emotions and things like that into what you're saying. So it comes back to the question of ethics, is like, you know, is how is this information being used and stored and kept? And of course, there's a big section here at the end on GDPR and keeping people's information as well. But I think it's an interesting conversation about, you know, where we're going with these chatbots and what they're representing, right?
Why is this any less ethical than anything else?
Why is it less ethical? No, I think it's a question of ethics in terms of where we're going with this technology, right?
But why? I mean, why is it any more of an issue than all the other things? What's so unethical about a bot?
No, I'm not saying it's unethical. It's a question of we've talked about this before on the show, is like, you know, there's a dangers that we've talked about inference and bias, right? Like, you know, when they try to use it for parole courts and stuff like that, they try to use AIs for that, and it tended to use the data at hand and convict, you know, African Americans harsher than by a factor of 8, if you remember, than white people, white convicts. And there's also the stories of you know, using them in medical triage, where in emergency rooms, where because, you know, patients who suffered from asthma and one other thing in a combination, it was like a sort of a toxic combination, they would just get whisked right into. So there was no data on those people, and so the AI would just send those people home because it didn't know, it hadn't caught, or the information wasn't recorded that these people were whisked right into ICU, right? So it's just sort of like how, where the danger is that, you know, not being aware of what the bias is that go into creating these programs, right? That's where the ethic question of ethics comes in. We don't agree.
It's unclear to me on some of the article talks about other related things like GDPR, and that is a good question as to whether some of these chatbots will handle GDPR regulations correctly. I'm not 100% clear on how that would end up being an ethical situation versus a legal liability situation. But I can see some of the argument that they're talking about here of, like, normally when you have a normal human being, you know, maybe they do have a really good CRM, customer relationship management system, where other people can see, all right, you know, what sort of interactions you've had. But it's all something that somebody sort of has to compile in their head and understand the context. Whereas in this case, I think what they're saying is the capacity of the chatbot to sort of instantaneously know, like, exactly which pigeonhole it wants to shove you into,
right?
Yeah. Ends up being, I could see that being an ethical concern, just because of the scale and speed of it being able to do that is a little bit different than, you know, a comparable set of flawed human beings trying to do.
Yeah, but you could
do
also,
well or not.
You could easily argue that a human is much more likely to snap to a judgment, right, than a machine.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure what point the article is trying to make. I mean, yes, there's always ethical considerations for all technology, but this article seems to be trying to talk about specific ethical issues of bots, chatbots, without it really giving any details about what's, you know, why should we worry about chatbots any more than we worry about anything else?
I mean, anybody who's talked to customer support, you know, knows that sometimes you spend more time trying to explain to somebody what the issue is than actually coming to a solution, right?
Right.
Because it's not written in the manual sitting in front of them. That's how it seems sometimes when you're talking to, you know, human tech support, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very often frustrating when you clearly know more about the situation than the customer support person that you're talking to, and they're supposed to be the expert. But they have that power, that password that lets them do something that you can't.
Right. Yeah. 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 Well, I mean, I was trying to make an appointment at an eye doctor the other day, and, you know, eye needed to have the appointment made, and I thought we were well on the way. She'd picked a date and she'd picked a time, and then she started arguing with me about whether I could come in on that day because it hadn't been a full year, full calendar year since my last appointment. Well, how is that my fault? Like, she should have realized in her system and said, oh, I can't fit you into that spot. Maybe she should have checked beforehand, and perhaps a bot would do that. Like, it would, know to do that. But yeah, it's like, and again, I ended up not making the appointment because I just got frustrated with the person on the phone, right? And I'll tell the doctor when I do make the appointment that I was not happy with that situation, but because that's when they've got a chance to do that, right? But
yeah.
But, and then he'll probably defend her, because she's just doing her job, right? But as a customer, I was unsatisfied with the interchange, right? So, and that happens, that's the kind of stuff that happens is they have their rules and they're not very good explaining to us what the reason why something can't, why part A can't go into part B. I don't know about you, but I tend to call tech support as few times as humanly possible.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, that's what these chatbots are doing now. They're replacing the frontline, questions, and then handing you off to a human if they can't resolve your problem, right? Anyway, my point was about this as we've been talking. The reason why it's follow up is because we've been talking frequently about how AI is the data we feed into it. It's only as good as the data we feed into it, and the inferences that can be built up over time are based on the data that are fed to these systems, right?
Yeah. No, I was just saying I didn't get the guy who wrote the article. I didn't get his.
Oh, he was a weak argument. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I found there to be no argument. what's he trying to say?
As I'm trying to read answer your question, I'm realizing that's the case too. It's a bit clickbaity in that sense.
Very much so. Yeah.
But and speaking of clickbaity, there's an article here that was written by a post here from this coming back to the, we should probably talk about this around the time we were talking about the Apple Pro Display XDR, because apparently you have to get a special cloth to wipe the an Apple provided cloth to clean the textured version of the Pro Display. It has that nano texture thing going on it. So a friend of the show, Joe Plichapinski, had posted here, and this is not follow up on the display, but follow up on the Apple Card, because we talked about Apple's statement that you should not expose your Apple Card to leather, and you should watch, be careful when you put it inside your jean pocket, so not expose it to too much denim. Turns out that Joe, for the last month or so that he's had his Apple Card, has been living in his leather wallet, and much to Apple's chagrin, and also in his jean pockets for months. So, and it looks brand new. So he just refers to this as covering your ass.
I have to beg to differ. I keep my Apple Card in my wallet, and it's one of these wallets where it's a little, little pocket where the card fits in. So two thirds of the card is covered by leather and one third is sticking up.
Yeah.
And very clearly there is a discoloration where it touches the leather all the time.
So do you think that is it sort of like a brownie color? Is that probably from some sort of dye that's been used in the leather in the tanning process?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether it's just the texture of the card. It's sort of if there's just enough texture that it's all, when it's constantly rubbing up against the leather, it just kind of soaks, absorbs the dye.
Well, it's painted titanium. It's not actually raw titanium, right?
Yeah. So maybe just the paint has a reaction, a chemical reaction to leather.
So I don't know, Greg, what do you think? Do you think a Twitter survey would be useful here?
Invoking him like a ghost?
I'm sure he has an opinion.
I also concur with Mark. I was looking at mine, and it does look like mine got a tan at the beach.
Yeah. Really?
Right? Like, I can sort of tell, like, oh yeah, I always leave it in the same orientation. Then you get a little bit of a little patina, a little finish on part of it,
and then the part that sticks out. That makes it, like, to me, the patina is something you need. You need to have that sort of gives you the nice wear and tear and antique-y sort of. I'm sure in 20 years people will be buying distressed Apple Cards, like distressed guitars, right? Where they made to look like they've been on the road for 20 years when in fact they're just brand new, right?
Yeah, I mean, I really only notice now as I'm looking sort of very closely at it when I'm using it out and about on a daily basis. I don't really see it under that sort of lighting, and it still wows people every once in a while. in a while, or they look at it sort of funny because it doesn't have any numbers on it.
Mm-hmm. I saw a Mac at work the other day. Look, I don't know about you, but like if you look at your keyboard, if you have a Mac you've had for years, I know people who type, like, you know, typesetters and stuff like that, who wear the letters off their keyboards because they use them so much, right? And I can tell which are the most used keys or most used part of a key, like a tab key or a space bar on my computer, because like, there's like a bit of a shine to it, right? Sure. The other day I saw at work, I saw a 15-inch MacBook Pro from 2015, actually, because one of the battery recall ones, where the guy's right-hand palm had rested on the, you know, the sort of rest area in front of the keyboard. The paint was all worn away. So God knows what he was, they have like sandpaper hands or some sort of bracelet or whatever. But like that kind of character that you build into your device by using it over and over again, I think that's, you know, that makes it unique in a sense, right? I mean, that said, I keep my iPhone with a cover and a case and a glass, you know, cover because I want to get maximum resale value when I go to flip it, right? But yeah, some things need to have that lived-in look, you know? We can't all drive around in Porsches and Lamborghinis, right? So we have 2 out of 3 Apple cards are now showing wear and tear.
Yeah,
and,
what I have to imagine is happening is this, right? So I don't have a slimline wallet. It's a trifold wallet. Mm-hmm. It's not a George Costanza wallet, so don't get confused. But it's definitely not the more sleek, minimalist wallets that a lot of folks tend to have. So my wallet, you know, unless I'm in a dodgy area, tends to be in my back pocket. So it's definitely taken the, you know, the brunt of pain in terms of being squished against the leather in the wallet. So I could see that versus, I don't know anything about sort of Joe's wallet situation. I'm going to guess he probably is the kind who would have a slimline and probably keeps it in a front pocket, so it doesn't end up with that immense pressure.
He probably has the most designer based wallet ever. He probably got a special wallet from some, you know, special designer wallet thing, knowing Joe.
A very, very tasteful one, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like special, you know, designer style, you know, art director. He's probably going to get one of those art director Macs I was talking about earlier. But I can report that my Apple cart is still in mint condition.
Because it's still sitting at the Apple office, hasn't been shipped to you yet?
Because it doesn't exist yet, exactly. Yep, I'm not even going to take it out of the package when I get it.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, that's it. So we missed a couple of things last week. We were talking, Alexis brought so much to the table here, so I don't know if you guys want to talk about this. We've talked about this a little bit before, but he's mentioned here that iOS 13 brings easier crypto APIs and crypto kit framework. And we're starting to see more third-party SDKs handle a lot of AWS authentication, that kind of stuff. So I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at any of these, some links he's put in here. Have you?
Let's see. So I see the URL request plus AWS, an extension on URL request to sign it for AWS, S3 signer AWS. Generates V4 authorization header. Oh, okay. I see. So this does the dance for you so that you don't have to worry about signed requests. It just sort of handles it for you, what it's doing. I see. Okay. Particularly with pre-signed URLs. I don't know if this is the right thing, so I'm just going to state what I think this is related to, and I could be wildly wrong. It looks a lot like something that I'm familiar with, where on AWS for S3, you could have your backend server say, hey, we would like you to upload some photos or videos. But we want to make sure that, like, not any sort of random person on the street can find our super secret S3 and just, you know, use it as their own hosting service. So we will provide this signed URL that is time sensitive, so it won't stay open in a legal place to output to forever. It'd be like 15 minutes, an hour. It's probably configurable. So you'll get a little signed URL from the service. You'll upload there and then tell the service, hey, I put this in the place that you wanted me to. And then it can go process that information however it pleases. I don't know how this might differ from the way I've used it, where it was make a backend request, get a, you know, in the JSON payload, get a signed sort of token URL that you would get and then use on the client side. It seems to me like this sort of does that for you. Like it talks to Amazon services and gets a signed one on your behalf using the SDK. So the client could just do it without having to set up a mechanism on your own backend side to do this.
Right.
I don't know if there's any, you know, if there's any similar backend configuration has to be done with this part, or if this is abstracted away something that Amazon has.
Are these meant to be used on the server side or like server side Swift or?
Well, it has a link out to Vapor's S3 signer. So that's where I'm a little unclear what the use case is. If this is the client one and then you switch over to the Vapor S3 signer if you're doing server side, or if this is actually meant on the server side.
Well, if only Alexis was here to talk about it. Okay.
You can hit us up at hashtag AskMDJC and tell us how horribly wrong we were about it.
Yeah, sure. All right, I'll go with your next one here, Jaime.
Yeah, this is a nice little article explaining sort of the history. This is from Use Your Loaf about self-sizing table view cells in Interface Builder. And most of the article shows like how not great the experience has been to this point of like really seeing what your self-sizing cells would look like in Interface Builder. But now there's a neat little option in Xcode 11. It says if you check the little automatic box, the table cell preview will now be fully self-sizing, which is neat. I think that's a good sort of quality of life sort of change. It's not going to be hugely dramatic. It's probably why nobody really talked about it. But now we're talking about it because I think this is nifty.
Well, Mark, you've talked about self-sizing stuff before.
Yeah, this has been an issue with Interface Builder for a long time. So automatic table view cell sizing has been around for a while. And they, you know, the boxy switch actually is not specific to Interface Builder. It's turning on the automatic sizing in the UI table view cell. But for forever, just Interface Builder would just ignore that. And even though it knew what the constraints were, it would not apply them. So you would get a visual representation of what the result of the auto layout was, like you'd normally get with just regular views in Interface Builder using auto layout. So they've finally, after all this time, and after they've signaled that Interface Builder may be going away, they've finally actually introduced this feature. But it's nice to have.
This isn't related to making anything automatic about self-sizing cells. It's about making the Interface Builder reflect what's going to happen?
Yes. Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So the automatic sizing has worked for a few years now. It actually works quite well, but it never at all, showed visually in Interface Builder what was actually happening.
Hmm. Interesting. Yep. Yeah. I thought I had implemented that in one of my apps, but I was disappointed to find out the other day that I didn't properly. So back to the drawing board. Back to Xcode 11 and see what's going on there.
Oh, they weren't in your app. They weren't sizing correctly.
Yeah. Because I adopted dynamic fonts a few years ago. So that the font would grow depending on the user's settings.
Yep.
But I would have thought that if I had done cell sizing cells correctly, it would have grown with the content, right?
Yeah, they should.
I mean, maybe they do. I don't know. I think I switched my.
But you wouldn't see that in Interface Builder until.
No. I'm talking. I'm looking at the app, but I think I was demonstrating to somebody the other day what the difference between dynamic fonts, using them and not using them, looks like in different apps, right? And I used my app as an example because I know I'd already implemented it, right? But I think I cranked the size up to a really huge size, and I don't remember the cells resizing.
Mm. Now, one thing that doesn't seem 100% there yet is the auto sizing in SwiftUI. In fact, table views in general in SwiftUI with custom cells still seem kind of funny to me, but maybe I just haven't used them enough.
All right. What's next? Tommy.
Well, there were updates out for iOS, iPadOS, presumably macOS, although I've not updated Catalina yet, so I can't speak too much of those. WatchOS, tvOS, and apparently HomePod, although I didn't actually check. I think of all the things, I did not update my HomePod. Don't actually even know where that is.
I always have to search for that. I can check it right now.
I'm trying to look to see where the updates.
Oh, you missed the fact that I've gone all Catalina on my machines at home here, Jaime. Except for
really?
Yeah. I updated my main machine last week, and of course, I got my test machine from WWC.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I've been using. I talked about this last week, but I didn't really talk about it. So my issue was I still use Adobe Illustrator from time to time, but I don't want to pull Adobe subscription price. So I made a partition for Mojave, and I installed just like a little small partition. I installed Adobe Illustrator on it as the only application there. So if I ever need in the moment's panic to use Illustrator, I can just fire up that partition, do my work, and then come back to Catalina and be fine, right? So I just made sure that the Illustrator would load, and I was satisfied enough that I could, make the leap into Catalina. But as well, during the Black Friday sales, I bought Affinity Photo for my Mac, and I also bought Affinity Publisher for my Mac. So if I need those tools, I can go and use Affinity products instead of Adobe products. That was follow-up from last week, because I'd mentioned I would talk about it, but I didn't. There, I did it. Just talked about it.
Cool.
Yeah, so of course, with iOS 13.3, there's also a new Xcode 11.2.1, I think.
Hey, Siri, stop. Sorry about that. had my headphones on, and I didn't realize that the HomePod had just kind of started playing music.
Oh, because could you hear it? Could you hear it? I heard something.
Yeah, and I had my headphones on, so I couldn't hear that it was actually playing music.
Oh, yeah.
But I kind of really quietly heard something, so that was me stopping. Sorry about that.
I wonder if it worked for me. Hey, furnace, stop.
Yeah.
No, furnace is dumb. I have a dumb furnace. Not smart at all. All right.
So, Jaime, you were mentioning a HomePod update. My home app is currently saying HomePod updating ... So I didn't tell it to, but it decided on its own that it needed to update, apparently.
Yeah, I was looking for mine, and I couldn't remember how to update it because it's in a weird spot. It's not on the HomePod itself. It's on the home, sort of upper left-hand.
Yeah.
And I said, it's already up to date on 13.3. It's like, I didn't update. Oh, because they switched on the automatic updates. Which I do not do because I'm paranoid.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. On my Apple TV, I've left auto update on, and I've got not the OS, but I've been using automatic updates on my iOS devices, like my iPad and my phone, because I have enough space for them to update. But haven't been burned by it yet. But yeah, I guess that day's coming, right? But I don't turn auto updates on the OSs at all. I think that's just playing with fire.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a really good sort of thing for them to do, considering they bricked HomePods with one of these 13 updates.
So, did they?
Yeah, I think it was the one immediately prior to this one, 13.2.
Yeah. We've been having challenges with different versions of Xcode running on whatever. We're still on Mojave at the office, but we're trying to update our Xcodes, and it keeps clobbering things because it wants to put new versions of Ruby in and all that other kind of stuff. And I think also in Catalina, they're removing a lot of the auto stuff that the command line tools used to put in, like is it Git that's changed or something? There's a few things, I don't know if you guys have heard, but a few of the tools, command line tools, have changed in, Python's not being installed. Speaking of your pick, Python's not coming in Catalina automatically.
Is that right? Really?
Yeah, there's a few other things that are, if you can Google something about that. Well, they removed Java a few years ago, right?
Oh, wait a minute. It's just saying Python 2.7. Oh, wait a minute. Python 3 also is not. So Python itself has been threatening to move to Python 3 for at least 10 years, maybe more than that now, but they actually now have done that. They've actually now made Python 3 the original. So let's see. So this article says the older Python language version 2.7, which is the old one, is being deprecated in macOS 10.15 Catalina and won't be included in macOS 10.16. Same goes for other Unix scripting languages. Sorry. This is not as bad as it sounds. Python 3.0 was released way back in December 2008. Yeah.
Right.
Skipping a few lines. For 10 years, it has been left up to users to install Python 3.x, a version which can be installed alongside of 2.7. Okay, details. Scanning to see if they actually are shipping 3.0. I mean, it sort of sounds from this article that they're shipping 3.0 in 10.16 instead of 2.7, which is not that big of a deal. Although it will break your old 2.7 scripts because they're not backward compatible. Well, actually, are you in front of a Catalina machine right now?
I'm on a Catalina machine.
Open the terminal window and just type Python --v.
--v or just -v?
I think it's --. Double check.
Let's try -v first.
Maybe it's -v.
I just spewed out a whole bunch of stuff. Oh, it says installing zipbook. What the hell did I do? Zip import hook, huh?
Yeah, no. Okay, it's Python --version.
By the way, it's not Bash anymore. It's not Z-shell, Bash anymore. Right?
It's C-shell. Yeah.
Because I heard some people talking about switching back to Bash after using Z-shell for a while.
Yeah.
I really don't see the difference myself.
Okay, so type Python space --version. Yeah. It's not just --v.
Kevin --. Well, normally with single dash with a single letter is the representation, but if you want the actual full name, you do --.
Right.
2.7.15.
2.7.15 on Catalina.
On the machine that I'm on. And this is an upgraded Mac. So what should it be at?
Well, mine is on 2.7.16, but I'm still on Mojave. But I might have upgraded Python on my own at some point. That's quite possible. I guess this doesn't really tell us whether Catalina shipped with 2.7.15 or whether you just had an old version in your USR directory somewhere. And
I've never used Python on this machine, so until just now.
Well, for sure, Mojave installed Python.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's just a matter of does Catalina, if it doesn't ship with it, it also doesn't clear it out.
Right.
Actually, try typing which Python.
Sure. User local bin.
Yeah, user local. Okay, so something installed it at some point.
Yeah.
And probably OS updates don't wipe out your user, especially your
okay,
user
so
local.
Here it is. Anyway. I found an article that talks about significant changes in Mac OS 10.15 Catalina of interest to Mac admins. One of them is, this one I knew about already, activation lock on the T2 chips. You can't, you know, if you have managed Macs or if you're using like any sort of firmware key or firmware password on the machine, you can't get past that if it has a on a T2 machine. But it says here that future releases of Mac OS will not include Python, Perl, or Ruby. Mm. They're still in Catalina, but a future will require a package install if needed, similar to Xcode command line tool installation. Python 2 is not recommended as it is end of life January 2020.
Yeah.
It will be removed from future OS like Java, or Java as Tammy would like me to say.
Not Java.
Java. I say Java, she says usually.
You say Java?
I say Java, right? Yeah, I don't know how you guys hear it.
Well, I hear it as Java when you just said it. I say Java.
Java?
Java?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you say?
Java?
Java, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, tell me. It's like I say Java, right? Like Wally. Unix shell will be changed from Bash to Z shell. How do you say Z shell? I say Z shell. Not Z shell, by the way.
I say Z shell. You don't say Z shell?
Yeah, I was kind of wondering about that.
Oh, I don't say Z shell, no. iTunes will now be broken, of course.
Oh, what if you're running your favorite text editor in the Z shell? Do you run the Z shell? But
Ed in the Z shell?
Ed in the Z shell.
It says TCC has expanded to documents, desktop, and download folders, trash, iCloud Drive. I don't know what TCC is. Any idea?
What's the context?
It says TCC has expanded to documents, desktop, download folders, trash, iCloud Drive, and other cloud stores as well as apps must require your permission to perform key logging or capture still or video images from your system. Okay, Project Catalyst will allow... Are we allowed to ship Project Catalyst apps yet? Do you know, does anybody know?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's some out there.
As expected, previously announced support for 32-bit processes will be removed, which we knew. Improved photos, notes, and reminders apps like iOS. You know, I beg to differ about the photos. Screen time is now available on all macOS. Sidecar feature is new. Accessibility improvements include voice control. I really like voice control. That's cool. I don't know if you guys have played with that or not at all. Apple Watch can now be used to approve app install, system preferences, unlock view passwords by double tapping the side button. Interesting. Hmm. The LP admin, which is printer driver, will stop working in a future worker of Cups. I forget what Cups is, but it's a printing system and built into Mac.
Yeah, right? Cups is an open source Unix printing system.
Interesting. Well, there you go. So I'll post this link in the show notes for those of you Mac admins out there. This is from June. Alrighty. So yeah, so we're at our pick section here. So why don't we just talk about your pick there, Jaime?
Yeah, it was arguably follow-up because a few episodes ago, Tim, you mentioned about learning a little bit of Python. And that's what my pick is here. It's Python for Beginners on YouTube. It's a series of videos on Microsoft's official channel. Yeah, they're small, for the most part, small little nuggets. So there's 44 videos. They range from 4 to 5 minutes upwards of, 15-ish minutes. So I don't know that it'll take all that long. It's not, hopefully not too intimidating, but they also break things up into sort of logical chunks of what you would sort of need to know, including sort of how do I even get started? In this case, they're talking about configuring Visual Studio Code, but it goes all the way through handling collections, loops, managing keys for what? Oh, probably keys within dictionaries, I suppose. Decorators and all sorts of stuff.
Cool. It's interesting. That reminded me that when I was first learning Objective-C, there was a resource I used to use called, and I looked in my bookmarks, which I don't really do very much anymore, but I had this guy named Rye from Rye Press. This guy named Rye had all these tutorials. He did a great Southern accent, and he would whip through different things about different features of Objective-C in these little like, 1 minute long videos. But I just went to the link, and of course Rye Press is gone. It is 404'd. So I have no idea who Rye is or where he's gone. And a sad day. Interesting. Alrighty. I guess that's it for another week, okay? So, hey, Jaime, people want to get in touch with you. Where would they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devwithahair.
And Mark, people want to get in touch with you?
markr@smapsoft.com.
Alright, my name is Timitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. And so next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
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 This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. This is friend of the show, Mike Van Ockmans. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. Please leave a comment on the website, and if you can, please write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you. So use the hashtag AskMTJC. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is at MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
I want to hear about your Apple cards.
Yeah. I've actually been disappointed. Every time I pull it out, it kind of looks a little gnarly.
Right, for wear? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Oh, well. I was warned not to put it in my wallet.
Indeed.
You were.
And I do think it was definitely a cover your butt situation for Apple when they put out the warning so it wouldn't be this huge news story. And I think it's pretty similar for the Mac Pro of like, look, use this special towel that we're going to give you so that it will not scratch or otherwise deface your monitor. And I can guarantee you there will be people on day one who decide to use Windex with some sort of, you know, sandpaper. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe it scratches so easily. All I did was take this buffing machine and try to polish it. And it completely destroyed my $5,000. Well, yeah, okay, sure. I mean, I think it's sort of getting out in front of the story, which is sort of weird that like Apple sort of has to like clickbait troll itself in order to tamp down some of the drama around this stuff.
Cool. Just finished watching The Report. Have you seen The Report?
No, what's that?
On Amazon Prime. It's about the 7,000-page report that the Justice Department did on the CIA about all the torture and stuff during
9/11. Yeah. Was it good?
Yeah. Well, it's got that sort of Aaron Sorkin vibe to it, but halfway through, I'm like, why am I watching this? Because it's just making me mad about American politics and partisan politics and, you know, how the Senate and the CIA and the FBI and the
If you want to get mad about American politics, just watch the impeachment hearings.
Yeah, no, I haven't. I haven't really gotten acquired a taste for that yet. I remember Watergate when I was a kid, right? I think I told you that we were actually in Washington the weekend that the story broke.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
I mean,
my sisters told me actually, because I think I was probably about 12 or 13 and we had gone to Washington for my dad probably had a job interview down there somewhere, but we went to the Smithsonian and the Capitol building and we didn't go to the White House. We went to the Senate building. I remember that. And there's some sort of railway that runs between the Senate and the White House, I think, or something like that. Or there's like a little underground railway there, like a shuttle. Cause I remember going on that. And then, but I remember the Smithsonian more than anything else. Right. And, yeah, and apparently that was the weekend that Watergate broke. And my dad was huge into American politics, right? So it was on every day. Came home from school and it would be on at like, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It would go for like a couple of hours. And then they would replay it, you know, when the parents got home from work. So it was like all Watergate all the time. All you could stand. It must have gone on for like a year and a half. I don't know how long it went on, but it was just, you know, that's when we all went and found other things to do. reminding myself how bad it was during the war on Terra. You know, intentionally pronounced that way.
Probably going to get worse.
Yeah, more war on Terra.
I've been watching something decisively less, more light than that. I've been watching Mrs. Maisel on Amazon Prime.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
it's actually pretty funny.
No, I'm just about to start season three. How far into it are you?
I'm done with season three.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Season three was good. I mean, you know, like anything else after three seasons, it's not quite as fresh as the first season.
Yeah, season one.
But it's still good.
Yeah, good. Don't wreck it for me.
No.
Yeah.
You know what else I watched that was pretty good was something called The Spy. Have you heard of this one?
Maybe. I don't know.
It was like a 6-episode thing on, I think it was on Netflix. It was starring Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yeah.
aka Borat, right? Mm-hmm. But in a serious dramatic role. Yeah, no, not funny at all.
Did you saw his speech on what was he talking about the other day on like a serious thing on?
The only thing I can think of is he was really hurt and upset about social media platforms.
Yes, about how Facebook and those kind of guys in control the dialogue, right? And teach people things that, you know, maybe they shouldn't be teaching people. Mm. Yeah, like, you know, yeah, it's they have a monopoly on conversations. I think what he was trying to say, right? But in a much more efficient way than I was just saying it, not just now. Mm. Yeah.
Yep.
I keep thinking we should transcribe some of these older episodes and turn it into some sort of a book, or as Jaime says, you know, the DVD collection or something, right?
Yeah.
Everybody's doing the ultimate box set, right? We should do an ultimate box set.
that'd be interesting.
Have you not seen every band that's out there? I guess, and again, maybe it's that iTunes economy or whatever, or lack of economy. They're all putting out their special edition, like Steve Miller put out a box set, and it's like, you know, $400 and, you know, Pink Floyd put one out and it's $400, and Eric Clapton just put one out, and they're all coming out with these, you know, they're digging through the archives of stuff you've never heard before and publishing it, right?
Well, it's hard to make money selling records these days.
Yeah. So, Mark,
if you're like Steve Miller, you're not going on tour 300 days a year.
Yeah, yeah.
To make their money. True. Sorry, what were you going to ask?
Well, I was going to say, because I don't know if, like, I mean, we talked about the Abbey Road album last week.
Yeah, and I listened to it. It was really good.
But did you hear the, like, not just the album, but there's also the extra cuts that come with it. Did you hear that on Apple Music?
Yep. Including
those are amazing.
Including the long one with Her Majesty in the original spot.
But yeah, which is earlier on in the song.
Which is between
right?
Me and Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam.
Right, kind of yeah.
And it actually fits.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting. I like the part. Was that the one where he starts singing? Or no, it was something else. He starts singing, you know, Because the World or whatever that song is called.
Yep. It's just called
He starts singing Fool on the Hill at the beginning.
Oh, I didn't listen to that one. Oh, I got to check that out. That's cool.
Actually, was it? Let me just see. I mentioned it on Twitter. Just was talking to somebody about it.
Maybe we should do an all music podcast. Because I have had some people kind of, you know, complain a little bit that we go off on these music tangents.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they want to hear more about Xcode.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, people like it when we talk about Swift UI and stuff like that. And
yeah.
We do the music tangents. I usually put those in the, I put those in the after show. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like last week, I left that one in the middle.
What did we talk about? I don't remember.
Abbey Road.
Oh, okay. Because Take One, no, it's instrumental. Let's see. Oh, I don't see it.
Yeah, I gotta find my tweets and replies.
Hang I don't on. See it. Another take of us.
No, it may not be because it's one of those songs that has a piano intro at the beginning.
Sun King, maybe?
Nope. I'm gonna find it. It's coming. Oh, yeah, here. I was listening to the original cut of Ballad of John and Yoko, which is John Lennon and Paul McCartney in the studio by themselves.
Mm.
And so John's playing acoustic guitar, and that's Paul McCartney on drums, right? And actually, I think I was talking to somebody, and he said when somebody asked who's the best drummer is Ringo the best drummer in the Beatles? And John says no, he's not.
Not even the best drummer in the actual quote is somebody asked him is Ringo the best drummer in the world?
Yeah.
And John said he's not even the best drummer in the Beatles.
right. On that track, yeah. And because Paul McCartney was sitting on the drums at that point.
But actually.
Beginning of Golden Slumbers. He's, you know, because he starts the piano bit and then he starts singing Day After Day.
Okay, let's see this one.
He's going to listen to it now, folks. On your home pod? Or I actually listened to that on my Echo the other day. It sounded pretty good. I've never actually played music on it.
What kind of Echo?
The tall one. What do you call that thing? It says Echo. Oh, it's a, you know, the one that's about 8 inches tall or whatever?
Mm-hmm. It's probably one of the newer ones, so it has like a fuzzy covering.
Yeah, it's got like a gray covering. It's about a year old, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, last Christmas, I think.
Yeah, I think they radically improved the sound quality out of those.
Yeah. Very bassy, like filled the room. But apparently, like, I asked it to play and it used Amazon Music to play it, but I thought for sure I had tied my Apple Music into it.
Do you have to tell it to play on Apple Music? Because I don't...
Maybe.
I don't know if you can set the default or not. Maybe you can check the settings.
Yeah, well, this is the Amazon app, but maybe, you know, maybe I did an update of the Amazon app and it changed the settings on me because things like that do that, right? Amazon Alexa, I got the Alexa app. Sorry, let's see what it does.
Jim, have you ever seen a movie called My Dinner with Jimmy?
My what?
My Dinner with Jimmy.
No, what's it about?
You might find it funny. I mean, it's not a great movie, but it's kind of a cute movie. It's about, apparently it's based on a true story about, you know, the band The Turtles?
Yes.
So.
Lo and Eddie.
Yeah. So before they were Flo and Eddie, when they went by their real names and they were in The Turtles, mm-hmm. they, the, the, the singer, the lead singer, so the guy who would become Eddie, wrote a memoir about their first, or a screenplay, actually, I guess it was, about their first trip to the UK as the Turtles. And it's basically stories about how they, you know, they were hanging out with Graham Nash and mm-hmm. Donovan and mm-hmm. Met the Beatles in a club and heard Sgt. Pepper before it was released. And then this sort of spoiling the movie, but it's not the point of the movie, the guy gets separated from the rest of the band and ends up meeting Jimi Hendrix and has dinner with Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, wow.
A lot of the movie I'd say about the first half of it is kind of, you know, leading up to who are the Turtles and where, you know, how do they end up going on this trip. It's a fictionalized version with actors. It's not a documentary. And with actors playing the parts of the band and everything. And then they go and he meets Jimmy, but the second half of the movie is just him sitting there with Jimi Hendrix having dinner. And I won't tell you how it ends, but it's kind of cool.
I have heard of that.
Yeah.
Maybe you told me before.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a great movie. It's not high art. It's not My Dinner with Andre, you know?
What's My Dinner with Andre? Is that a different thing?
That's a different thing. That was this like artsy movie from, I think, the 70s, the whole movie was just two guys having a intellectual conversation. And it's considered like this art film classic, you know, but I've never watched it. But you might get a kick out of this. It's cute.
Jimmy, all right.
My Dinner with Jimmy.
We'll have to check it out.
Yeah.
For sure.
The thing I've been watching this week has been the 5-episode crossover for Crisis on Infinite Earths.
This is in the
CW shows.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the final 2 episodes won't be until January 14th.
What?
So they're taking the winter break. But it is the most ambitious crossover I've ever seen in a TV series.
Huh.
Is the crossover, the Arrow, Flash,
Batwoman,
Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow.
Oh, really?
And a whole bunch of others. But this year, they brought in all these different cameos and sometimes more than cameos. So they brought in, Brandon Routh plays 2 different characters. So his normal Legends of Tomorrow character and a version of Superman.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Basically the one he played before.
Yeah.
They brought back, I can't remember this dude's name. He played Arliss on the HBO series.
Hmm.
But he was one of the reporters from the 1989 Batman. They brought back the guy who played Robin in the 60s Batman.
Oh, yeah. Burt Ward.
Burt Ward. Thank you. They brought in Tim Conroy, who does the voice of the animated Batman.
Oh, right.
Like,
yeah.
It's just like you blink and I'm like, oh, my God, did I miss another thing? It's just wild the way that they took this whole scheme and said, how much fan service can we pack into an hour episode? And they've delivered on that for sure.
Mm.
With their you know, CW budget.
Is that a big budget?
No. It's like a lot of the CGI is like, you know, it's not 1990s tech. It's like late 2000s tech, you know, because they have to use it a lot. There's some things that are done pretty well. Like the costumes are actually done pretty well, but these portals that they're using to go between the different Earths on the Infinite Earths thing is like pretty cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of story that's forced of like, hey, I'm a dude. Cool. I'm going to move the plot along. But it's actually holding together a whole lot better than you would think.
So why is it called Infinite Earths? Is it like different, like multiple universes kind of thing or what?
Yeah, like for example, Supergirl takes place in a different universe than Arrow and Flash were in the same universe. I don't remember where the Legends of Tomorrow come from. Black Lightning is in his own universe, but he also made an appearance in this series.
I'm looking at Crisis on Infinite Earths, and that's coming to Batwoman. In fact, I'm on IMDb. I'm looking up the different parts here. So you remember the guy you were looking for, the one you couldn't remember his name?
I don't remember his name, but if you look up right here, let me look it up.
So part one is Supergirl, right? According to this, season 5, okay, episode 9. For those of you driving at home,
Arliss stars Robert Wool, who played who in Batman 1989. Does that not show up in his Wikipedia entry?
Will Wheaton's in there too.
Oh, there we go. Alexander Knox. He was one of the reporters, so he reprises that character.
So what character does Burt Ward play in this part 3?
I don't even know. I gotta have to watch the scene again. I'm not sure if he's intended to be Robin or if he's just a dude dude walking his dog who happens to be recognizable as Robin, especially with his exclamation.
Holy Batman.
Like, holy red skies something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So is there a way to watch this stuff without having to watch all these different shows? Like, will it ever be on like Amazon or Netflix or something?
Without having to watch the shows.
Because I've never watched a single episode of Daredevil or Arrow.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I come into it knowing slightly more because I regularly watch Supergirl, and I've been watching this first season of Batwoman. I never really got into Flash or Arrow, so they do a decent job of recapping what you need to know. Mm-hmm. And I think if you remember anything at all from the comics, that's probably good enough to get you past. Like, you won't pick up on some of the particulars of some of the relationships. I'm like, who's that dude? All right, I guess he's important. He seems like that person trusts him, so he must be a trustworthy person.
Right.
Otherwise, it's more just comic book fun.
Yeah. Well, I
think you probably could just watch The Crisis and more or less get what's going on.
Yeah,
it would have helped if you'd seen the previous crossover from last season.
Yeah.
That would be helpful. It's each of these crossovers has been helpful in defining what's going on here.
Yeah, I watched like the first season of Flash, and I watched a couple of maybe three seasons of Supergirl, but it got a little tiring. And then I'm watching Batwoman a little bit. I've got a few episodes behind on that. So yeah, I got tired of Flash after like the first season, and like I said, never got into Arrow at all.
People get into the different stuff.
Yeah.
I would say that the Lex Luthor that they have here is one of the best.
Who
really
plays Lex Luthor in? Oh, I think here.
He's the other guy, the guy who's not Charlie Sheen in Two and a Half Men.
Oh yes, John Cryer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he plays. So,
sounds about right.
I like the guy who plays Brainiac, but not as menacing as a Brainiac I remember from the comic books.
Well, did you see the Brainiac 5 from Legion of Superheroes? It takes place in the 30th century.
No.
So that's who he's based on.
You're making shit up now.
I'm not making shit up. This is legit. Brainiac 5 from Legion of Superheroes. Brainiac original is the villain from Superman you're thinking of. I don't recall the relationship between Brainiac and Brainiac 5.
Yeah, I just remember Brainiac. I'm talking from the comic books where he would capture cities in these little glass domes and stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's villain Brainiac. That's different than
goofy Mork
descended Brainiac. I'm not sure.
Yeah, the current Brainiac's a bit like Mork from Ork. You know, he's trying to fit into Supergirl's world. But speaking of weird crossovers, I saw a picture today of I think there were five Doctor Who's in the room, and I think they had two other Doctor Who's on iPads, like doing FaceTime, like having a Doctor Who tea. So David Tennant was there, you know, Matt Smith was there, David Tennant's father-in-law was there. He played one of the Doctors in the original series, and a couple of other people. Kind of interesting thing. That's coming out soon. Oh, January 1st, I think, is Doctor Who's coming back on the air, right?
Did you say Jan 1st?
January 1st, yeah.
Okay.
New Year's Day. So we're hijacking this podcast to do a brief spotcast, I guess, right? Mm-hmm.
I noticed that. People who complain about this.
I just started randomly talking about what I was watching.
Mark was hoping we'd break into like prog rock, right?
Yeah.
Hey, if you ever watch Smallville, they have Clark Kent and Lois too, I think.
Oh, Smallville. Yeah, so, yeah. That was...
It's like they said, okay, which actors are vaguely still available from anything that's ever been shown superhero-wise? Mm-hmm. Cool. Let's get them. Let's shove them into an episode somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those, like, how did they even make this sort of things? Because I know they don't have a ton of budget. Like, it's very clear they spent more on these annual crossovers.
Right.
But still, it's like a big downgrade in budget when, like, Supergirl went from CBS to CW.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Maybe the Riverdale stuff, is highly profitable. It's super cheap to shoot. Probably makes tons of bucks. Maybe they can reapportion it.
Have you been watching Rick and Morty?
I have been watching Rick and Morty.
You have? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. I think they missed a week, but maybe, yeah. Interesting. How many episodes is there? 6 or 8 or 10 or do you know?
I figure what they normally have, it's around 10-ish, I think. So we still have a few more to go this season.
Yeah, they got a lot of comments in there, right? Like about, what was he saying? He said something about this is like good enough for the finale, season finale.
Rick and Morty is so weird with that. He's like, yeah, maybe he'd do this. This is really good enough for the finale, Rick and Morty. But it's good. Yeah. The whole style of how they do things is odd. And I think they're signed up for like 7 more seasons or something. They will die before they finish those 7 seasons at the rate at which they make them.
Hmm.
So we'll see what ends up happening there. Yeah, I hope this season of Doctor Who they end up doing a little bit more character development for some of the characters.
Yeah, it's the first season, right? So, did you see on the New Yorker cartoon was they had Idris Elba dressed up as Santa Claus, and the caption was, "You've been doing this for like centuries. Why don't you let Idris Elba have a turn?"
And I did not see that. Related, there is a new Bond movie coming out, and the trailer's out for that
already.
Mm-hmm. No Time to Die has a trailer out there. Wonder Woman 1984 has a trailer out there.
Yeah. Anywho, I guess we'll follow the day. So I can go off and watch some television before I go to bed.
All right.
All right. Till next
talk
week.
At you later.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.